Call the first case, Jessica Gay versus Virginia Beach Department of Human Services. Have counsel signed in already? There's a sign-in paper?
Your Honor, Ms. Adams signed in. Ms. Adams came in a minute ago. I'm not sure she's aware of the form.
I'm getting thumbs up that
Is
it an argument?
Oh, okay.
So you don't intend to...
I do not intend to present an argument today.
All right. You're the guardian?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you so much for being here. That's been something that our court has been concerned about. Sometimes the guardian ad litem does not come. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please be here this morning.
All right. Thank you. All right. We're ready to move forward. Ms. Messman?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
And, Your Honor, I apologize that I'm one-handed, so I will be as conscious about that as humanly possible.
Winging it takes on a different meaning.
Here. Oh, goodness gracious, it sure does.
Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. If I may reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, that'd be perfect.
2 minutes,
thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it may please the court, my name is Michael Messman, and I do represent the appellant, Jessica Gay, in this matter. Your Honors, as you're aware from the briefs that you have been submitted to you all, this case is a termination of parental rights. And, Your Honor, the reason that I'm here in particular is that under the code section, and I want to be very clear, and just so the court is aware, the three of us made this argument in the circuit court. So these are not new attorneys. We have been involved with this case at the circuit court level. Ms. Adams and Ms. Alardi have been involved much sooner in the case than I was. But Ms. Alardi was very consistent and very conscious about making sure that we were concise in our argument. And, Your Honor, she was very good about pointing out that the section was 16.1-283C2, and that's where the argument begins. And to be perfectly frank, that's where it ends. And, Your Honor, I know that you're all fully aware, but let me read it anyway. Mm-hmm. The residual parental rights of a parent or parents of a child placed in foster care as a result of court commitment, an entrustment agreement entered into by the parent or parents, or other voluntary relinquishment by the parent or parents may be terminated if the court finds, based upon clear and convincing evidence, that it is in the best interest of the child, and that's where the whole argument begins. The parent or parents, without good cause, have been unwilling or unable within a reasonable period of time not to exceed 12 months. Your Honor, this case is just replete with areas where this particular mom has put in all of the efforts that she possibly could. And what was the most frustrating to me as the attorney coming in so late into the case is that it felt like every time the department gave mom guidelines and rules, she would meet those. Not perfectly, but meet them. And then all of a sudden it would change again. Let me give you an example. Throughout the transcript, it points out how mom, when she was released from incarceration, and I know the court has read this transcript, I know that you're fully aware, but when she was released from the actual incarceration, it was then, okay, you need to find housing. Well, she moves to New York with her fiance, and then New York says, no, he's not good enough. So then she comes back to Virginia Beach, all the while still maintaining visitation with her children. This is not your typical case where these children were removed because of abuse, because of neglect. It was a mom who was living in a homeless shelter, who did not have financial support from the father, who then has these outstanding warrants, who turns herself in. She had a care plan in place, and the person who was providing that care was then unable to provide care for these children. Again, this is not a situation where we have battered children, we don't have abused children, and to be perfectly frank, we don't even have neglected. She provided a plan and it fell through. From that moment forward, then her life altered and shifted to where she had to meet the requirements dictated by the Department of Human Services. And that's what's so frustrating, because it wasn't that they came to her, these children were placed with them, and then all of a sudden it's, you will follow whatever rules I put in front of you. Whatever hoops I put in front of you, you're going to jump through those. She would jump through them, and then there would be a new hoop. And then there's a new hoop. And then it took 4 long years of hoop jumping to get to this point. During that time, and as the transcript has indicated, these children are not doing great. They are just having horrible foster care experiences. That is not the department's fault, and I'm not insinuating that it is, but what I am suggesting is the fact that if it is in the child's best interest to have their termination of parental rights, then they must be placed in a situation where the kids are doing better than if they were with their mother. That is not the case here. And that is not what was presented in court. These two children, per this transcript, are now living in separate and apart from each other. They don't live with their mother. They don't live with each other. And instead, we expect them to do well. They have this adjustment disorder. And again, per our brief, there was no medical evidence that insinuated or suggested that their behaviors were directly related to the fact that their relationship with their mother had become so strained. But as smart, intelligent people, and you have young kids, certainly that could actually be a cause of this. This is not a situation where this mother gave up. She never threw her hands up. She never said, "Forget it, I don't care anymore." She came from poverty. She lived in poverty. That is not a reason to terminate parental rights. It is not a reason to terminate parental rights because you're sleeping on a couch. And if that's the case, and if that's the standard, then gosh, oh golly, we're going to have a lot more kids in foster care. The situation arose that every time she met with the social worker, it was, "You must do this." "Okay, I've done that. I've gotten employment." "Oh, but in Virginia Beach," and I know, out of Richmond, but in Virginia Beach, work is seasonal. If you're a housekeeper, you work for the summer, and then that's it. Again, not good enough, but that's not what the standard requires. The standard says it must be in their best interest and without good cause. Without good cause. So every time that we reflect back on this record, we have to look at what mother did. What was she doing? And she was at every court appearance. She was there every single time that the court required her to be there. Whenever they said, "You need a new place to live," she brought that, a new place to live. And the department, of course, when it was vetted, not good enough. The problem that we have is that we have abdicated the parents' rights and responsibilities to the department and said, "You get to choose when and if these kids get to live with their mother. You get that right." We have now said, per this case, per some of these previous cases that Judge Shockley alluded to, was, well, you know, housing's an issue. Money's an issue. So we have said, okay, Department of Human Services, you get to determine when a parent is good enough. And that is not what the case law says. That is not what the Supreme Court has said. A parental right is fundamental above everything else. And to terminate that parental right, it has to be egregious. It can't be because, oh, I don't have a house to live in.
Well, counsel, what about the best interest of the child, though?
Yes, ma'am. And there are nine factors that go into the best interest of the child. Not one of them is housing. Not one of them is the financial ability of a parent. The best interest of the child is the relationship that the parent maintains with the child, the propensity of the child. That's absolutely one of the factors as well. It's the propensity of the parent to support ongoing relationships with other children, to meet the emotional needs, to meet those needs of their children. It does not say anywhere ever that the mother's ability to meet the requirements of the Department of Human Services for housing and employment. And so, Your Honors, as I stand here and as this case came before me, and even Judge Shockley, per the transcript, it states, and then I want to quote that, and it is in my brief as well, the court stated, "And as I said to begin with, I don't think Mom has intentionally not complied. I don't know whether it was because of her own upbringing," and we see this all the time. "Defendants don't get to court because nobody ever told them they had to get up when their alarm went off. I mean, the way you're raised and your background sometimes doesn't give you the tools you need to be able to cope. So I'm not putting the blame with Mom at all." Well, then you can't get to the code, because the code specifically says the parent without good cause. If the court is not blaming mother, then you can't get to the code.
Yet these circumstances persisted for 4 years, you said?
They did, Your Honor, per the transcript, and they did. But the circumstances changed. And let me back you up a little bit and go with you there. When the department said you had to have a place to live, okay, she did. They didn't like that place. Then it said you had to do this visitation. She did. Now, did she go to every single visitation? She missed them periodically. But she came from New York and drove to Virginia Beach and got herself for those visitations. Then it was, you need a parental capacity evaluation. Completed. Then it was, you need individual counseling. Completed. Then it was, you need drug testing. Completed. Then it was,
but she tested positive, didn't she?
Not the first few times, no.
Well, first few times. We're talking about hopefully batting 1,000 on that, not 500.
Well, Your Honor, to be perfectly frank, and I'm being as candid as possible, the code does not say because you tested positive for marijuana, you lose custody of your children. It doesn't say that. It specifically, and the department...
But when you have lost custody of your children, they're in foster care, wouldn't you expect better of the mother who doesn't have the money for stable housing to not be able to go out and use drugs?
Your Honor, the expectation, and again, and I want to be so respectful when I say this, that's not what the code says nor requires. It does not say because you have lost custody of your children, you have a higher expectation as a parent.
To abide by the law?
Well, Your Honor.
Last time I checked testing positive, the use of drugs is illegal.
And, Your Honor, I'm not in disagreement with you saying that it's illegal. But what I am suggesting to you is illegal activity does not equate termination of parental rights.
Well, doesn't it factor into best interest of the child?
Your Honor, to be perfectly candid, if you're able to provide care for your children, and remind you, she didn't have custody of her kids. She wasn't monitoring her children.
But she was trying to have custody of her children.
She was, but she was not in a caregiver role. And it is, and I understand that. And I understand the frustration from that. I do. And I'm not minimizing that. But what I am saying to the court is that she had been through this process for an extended period of time and had come clean on all of these tests. And again, one more hoop was placed in front of her. And she fell off the wagon, or whatever it was, and tested positive for marijuana.
Well, technically, the code only requires DSS, I mean, it only requires a 12-month period. And as Chief Judge Huff pointed out, this went on for 4 years. So, essentially, doesn't that indicate that DSS was bending over backwards to try and get the, you know, this mother in a position where she could take custody of her children?
And, Your Honor, the answer simply is no. And the court is fully aware of this. Court hearings take forever. Parental capacity evaluations can take up to 9 months to get completed. So to have the standard arbitrary number of 12 months...
Well, but that's what the General Assembly has chosen to make it.
It has. And, Your Honor, but that doesn't negate the... And at the 12-month mark, where was she at that point in time? According to this code section... The rights had not been terminated. At the 12-month mark, the court should have returned her children to her. If that's what we're saying is within this 12 months, because without good cause, what I'm suggesting to this court is that if the 12-month is the mark, well, then if they have substantially met the requirements, those children should be returned. It should not be up to a trial court to then turn around and say, well, you know what, the parental capacity evaluation isn't complete, but we're still going to keep her kids in care. So we have to be very careful when we say this 12-month. What I am insinuating to the court is the fact that every time there was a court hearing, there was a new requirement that was placed on mom. And that is throughout the transcript, is that what exactly was the expectation for mom? And then show me where she didn't meet those expectations. And the answer is she did meet them. And then we would change them. We would add more. So the 12-month was extended by the department, not by mom. And that's what I'm submitting to the court as well. And so, again, I understand that it is a situation where it is the best interest, but again, under the 9 statutory factors that go into the best interest of the child standard, not a single one of the arguments by the department applies.
Well, Rajay, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, was in first grade when she entered foster care, correct?
Yes, sir.
And shortly after
I believe
that,
that's correct.
She had 6 teeth removed. 6 cavities filled and 2 spacers put in for their adult teeth. Now, how is mom maintaining or meeting her needs when it comes to dental care?
Your Honor, we have no idea why her teeth were the way that they were.
But they were the way they were.
And that is, we can't put that on mom. We can't say,
you can't expect mom to maintain the dental hygiene of her child?
We don't know why those teeth were removed. We don't know if it's because this child has a vitamin deficiency. We don't know those answers. So
isn't mom doing the wrong thing by not even noticing it and getting it to the proper place to find out why it's going on?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the transcript that indicates she wasn't. There's nothing that indicates
except
she hadn't taken...
Except that it was happening. And the only time anybody took notice of it is after the child enters foster care.
We don't know that, Your Honor. And that's what I'm saying to you. The transcript does not indicate...
But we do know that that's when these things were noticed, is after she entered foster care, because that's when the rotten teeth were removed.
We don't know if that's the first time they were noticed. We don't know if they weren't noticed
so
in the
mom
school.
So mom noticed that she had rotten teeth and just did nothing about it?
Your Honor, I cannot. I would be remiss if I were to come up here and say that I knew
but
that...
But we take the evidence and the facts in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, which is the department. And the reasonable inference of that is that mom wasn't doing anything to maintain the dental hygiene of her child.
And, Your Honor, and I see that my time is going into my rebuttal, so I want to be very respectful of the time. I appreciate what you're saying, and I respect what you're saying. However, that is not part of the transcript, what mother knew about dental care or did not know. And I would
but
submit...
But we're talking about the reasonable inferences gained from the evidence.
Your Honor, and the reasonable inference gained from that evidence is that that child had six cavities, and that, yes, her teeth were taken care of, and thank goodness that
six
they were.
Six cavities and six teeth that had to be removed.
Yes, Your Honor, for a six-year-old. And, Your Honor, to be perfectly frank, it's not entirely uncommon for children to have these type of issues. Again, dental care is not the prerequisite to terminating a parental right, which is a fundamental core right.
But it's another factor to be lumped in with all of the others, correct?
It is correct. I would concede that you are correct in that fact. However, again, this is not a totality of circumstances. It is a what is in the best interest and that without good cause. And, Your Honor, that's what I would submit. And, again, I'm in my rebuttal time. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. For the department.
I apologize.
Thank you. I too, am challenged, but it's a height thing. So I can't do anything about it. May it please the court. My name is Elena Ilardi. I represent the Department of Human Services with the City Attorney's Office of Virginia Beach. It seems as though we've spent a lot of time in the last however many minutes hearing about the facts. But, Your Honor, let's be clear, this is a court of appeals, and you have to defer to this trial court. And if you read the record, particularly if you read my summary of the record and the facts that of the appellee brief, you'll see that there are just many, many facts that support this trial court's decision. And while Ms. Mesman did come into this case later and has done a fantastic job representing her client on appeal and characterizing the evidence that there was a changing game throughout this case, there was never a changing game throughout this case. Ms. Gay was a person who had chronic poor decision-making in her parenting and chronic instability. And that was the evidence that we presented to the trial court, that not only from 2 months old for Rajay, the court learned of the fact that Ms. Gay obtained a finding for her poor, inadequate housing when she was living in a roach-infested, messy home with her mother, barely having a place to stay, and that ultimately led to the death of Rajay's twin. That was the first evidence we had regarding how she parented and how she lived with her family. And frankly, the case was handed to ongoing. We didn't have much involvement with her individually. We did have involvement with the family members. I know Ms. Messman in her brief had argued that that shouldn't have been reviewed, but obviously the agency has an obligation to look at family members. It has an obligation to try to find ways to get these children out of foster care before 3.5 years in. It was unable to do so. There were no family members that could provide a safe and stable house for these children. With respect to what we sought from Ms. Gay. Ms. Gay, because of this chronic poor decision-making, it wasn't that she was just incarcerated for some random unknown event. She had a series of crimes that she had done such that when she went and turned herself in, she wasn't even allowed to be released on her own recognizance. She got the 90 days because of her own decision making, and so the agency didn't want to send the children back. The court didn't want to send the children back to someone and have them right back into foster care. So it said, let's get a parental capacity evaluation, let's get you stable, and send your kids back. Instead of initiating the parental capacity evaluation as soon as she got out of jail, she moved to New York. That was her choice. She was given weekly visitation, but she didn't attend it. And in fact, she didn't actually just move to New York and say, I'm going to New York. She moved to New York and claimed that she was going to stay in Virginia Beach, and so there was never a plan to change the visitation because it was uncertain exactly where she was. So she ended up missing most of those visitations before the first permanency planning hearing. At the time of the first permanency planning hearing, we had a disapproved ICPC home study on her from New York. She was back here. She was willing. She was doing the parental capacity evaluation. Part of that home study showed that she popped positive for marijuana. So part of the parenting capacity evaluation that she was always required to do, along with its recommendations, said, let's make sure you're clean. That's one of the things. And it also said, let's make sure you do counseling because these interactions and the difficulty you have in maintaining employment and maintaining stability of housing is partially because you don't know how to deal with people. So get into the counseling. That was from the outset.
As you can see from the record, Ms. Gay never really did that. The moment that we thought she was in counseling, that she came to the court, and this is about the third permanency planning hearing. So arguably, we're way past what the General Assembly says in terms of returning the children to mom. At that point, mom says, I'm in counseling. I've identified a house. I can't pay for it, but the agency's saying it will help me pay for it. I've got a job. I'm stable now. Give me a chance with my kids. And the court said, okay, I'll give you a chance with your kid. And the agency said, here's over $600 for the deposit. Here's over $600 for the rent. You know, here's a parent coach to try and work with you on the relationships of these kids, which, by the way, was lacking because mom wasn't attending visitation despite every warning that it was affecting the children. And we end up with mom not paying a single month's rent. This argument that she's a professional home cleaner is ridiculous. She's not getting a job, any job, minimum wage, you know, McDonald's, any job during the time, I don't know why, she's not getting one. We say do counseling so that you can figure that out. She doesn't do it.
Well, did she have the seasonal employment as a housekeeper?
She had some seasonal employment, but there's nothing that prevented her from working during the other months of the year. I mean, it's something else. I'm not sure what her thought is that she can only work a couple months a year. That doesn't make any sense. She has to take care of these children. She has to provide something for them. But again, that's not even the primary issue, because the primary issue is that she wasn't even visiting the children, and she wasn't testing clean on her drug screen. So she had one screen that was clean when she had come back from New York, and then when the judge in lower court gave her this chance and got her into the housing, she tested positive before that hearing, and so the judge said, okay, I'm still going forward with this plan, but test clean the next time. And that was the screen that she dodged. That, you know, she didn't tell the agency. That was the hair follicle screen that she didn't tell the agency that she had been evicted. She came and said to FAP seeking rent payments, and then after FAP she was supposed to have a hair follicle and she didn't do it. And so as of the trial court and circuit court, there had not been a test. There had not been a clean hair follicle test to demonstrate that in the 6 months that she wasn't working, not in counseling, not in stable housing, that she had even done the drug screen and demonstrated that she's clean. At the time of the trial, it was 6 months after the JDR court TPR. And that happened without her presence. She didn't show up to court on time. She came afterwards, which is why, you know, she didn't get to make her case in juvenile court. But the case was continued at the three-month point because of a change in counsel. Ms. Messman came in. So she ended up with 6 months' time between the date that the JDR court terminated her rights and the date she was before the circuit court saying, I'm going to do something differently. And she'd done nothing. Nothing on that initial plan. The initial plan had said parenting capacity plus recommendations, which was counseling, stable housing, stable employment. None of that was in place at that time. And so we've got these two kids, 3.5 years of languishing. Now, Ms. Messman's additional argument is that you should think, again, without evidence in the record, there's really no support for her argument that siblings should stay together. The agency had tried to keep these girls together, unfortunately, frankly, because poor Renaya had moved 4 different homes based upon the unsubstantiated allegations of her little sister. And she was over it. She was over her sister, and she was over the moves. And at the time that we did the termination in circuit court, Renaya's foster parents felt that they could handle Renaya's behaviors. They loved her. They wanted to adopt her. But they couldn't handle Rajay. So at that point, you're saying, should Renaya lose another placement for the, you know, not therapeutically supported assumption that sisters should stay together? And the therapists, the GAL, the former GAL, all were saying these children really can't stay together anymore because it's just harming Renaya. Rajay's behaviors are affecting the stability you can achieve for Renaya. So at the time of the trial court, the plan was to place Rajay with her father's ex-fiancé, who's also the parent of her half-siblings. And obviously, I can't, I mean, it's not relevant to this court. It's not part of the record what happened, but she is in that placement. And the children are separated. But while they were in care, in this trial record, they were together. So any harm that's going on about how they were in foster care wasn't coming from the separation of the sisters. They were together for the whole case up until really recently. Um, I think I really think that this court needs to recognize that there hasn't been, by the trial courts, this deference to the department in terms of what it wants to do. It has looked at the facts regarding whether it could get these children out of foster care, place them with mom stably, and there hasn't been a moment in this case when that was possible. And it is the case that 3.5 years, that it lasted that long, and not because we're unwilling to file for termination, but because everyone wanted to give this mother a chance. Everyone felt that the removal for her instability seemed like, really, can't we just send them back? Can't we get to that place? And at each hearing, it wasn't the agency that was adding a new restriction. It was the mother who hadn't done that minimum, that basic level, to give anyone comfort that these children could safely be placed with the mother. And even when they were almost placed, in that time frame when the agency essentially was paying for her housing, or no one was paying for it, she was ultimately evicted, in that time frame...
How in the world did that work? Explain that to me. That she was given the money and she just never paid?
So in order for FAP to give money for a parent to have... what the agency says is, we can't provide you housing. But if you can identify a house that requires a deposit and first month's rent to get into it, we can go to FAPT and get funding for the deposit and first month's rent. So, but you have to prove that you can pay for it ongoing. So she was able to provide proof that she had worked enough months, and I guess in her seasonal employment, that she could pay for the rent. She proved that she had an income stream. So they paid the deposit and the first month's rent.
She just failed to pay.
And then from that point forward, she wouldn't give any evidence that she was... She would say, you know, oh, I forgot it, I'll have it to you, whatever. But she really didn't have any, we think. But she certainly wasn't paying the rent. And so she ended up with an unlawful detainer. And then towards the end of that placement, maybe... I'm not sure whether it was because she didn't have any housing or because she was frustrated with the fact that she knew she was about... The whole thing was about to come down. But in the last so many weeks of... before the agency discovered that she was evicted, she started missing these visitations again. And so yet again, the children were in this place of, I don't have a mom that's going to meet my needs. And she wasn't. And then when she did go to FAPT and she asked for the payment, FAPT was able to say, sure, we'll pay ongoing. We can't pay, you know, retroactively. So again, had she been honest in those months when she had lost her job, and had she been seeking payment then, it's unclear. It's possible FAPT would have given her some money for those next couple of months and tried to bridge her. She didn't ask for it. She's never asked for assistance with employment, which is an argument in the appellant's brief. She never asked for it. We never thought that that was some concern that she had. We thought, get into counseling and you can keep the job that you have.
So. During the course of her argument, Ms. Messman referred to the investigation into Ms. Gay's moving to New York and that residence is, quote, being not good enough. That's not what I understand the reason that placement was not, that housing situation was not approved by the department. Can you refresh my recollection as to some of the various reasons?
Yes, when a parent, when they move out of state and a child is in foster care, the court cannot make a placement to an out-of-state home unless it is approved under the Interstate Compact for Placement of Children. So we sought an ICPC home study on the residence that she was in. And that ICPC home study from New York was denied. They denied placement because mother had a pending charge. The boyfriend had...
In New York.
I believe in New York. The boyfriend had a pending charge down in Virginia. They had a DV history in Virginia, the boyfriend and mother. There was CPS history from the boyfriend's parents who were also in the home. And mother tested positive for marijuana. So all of those things combined made New York say that you can't send the children up here.
It wasn't just that the apartment or whatever it was wasn't good enough.
Right, it wasn't the apartment, and frankly, it wasn't the decision of Virginia Beach or the Virginia Beach courts. It was a decision made in New York that affected mother's decision, and then mother came down to Virginia to find housing in Virginia. And similarly, when mother was living, Ms. Messman is arguing, well, mother was living in housing with this cousin, Michelle Whitehead. Michelle Whitehead wouldn't answer the agency's calls and wouldn't say, yes, the children can live in my home, and here's my home. And when she finally did, months and months later, in February of the following year, they come to see the home and discover that this boyfriend with a criminal record is there. And no one has discussed the fact that there's another person living there who has a barrier crime, and the children can't be placed with him. So
when Mom moved to New York with her boyfriend, there was reference made to her still making a lot of effort to come back to Virginia for the visitations. And am I correct that she made 5 of 13 visitations during that period of time?
I believe so, Your Honor. And then when she got back to Virginia, she also missed, I want to say, 3 of the 5 visitations since the time when she was back. So it was, not only was she missing them when she was living in New York, but when she came back down here and then they were just down the street. And again, these visitations are talking about her 1 hour a week. You know, it's a precious hour, but if you can't even get to the visitation for 1 hour a week, it's a difficult thing to ask a court to transfer custody to that parent. Your Honor, I don't have anything further. If you have no further questions for me.
Hearing none, we thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
Very brief.
Yes, ma'am.
Your Honors, page 10, well, in the appendix, the transcript is very specific in the the brief that I wrote. This is from the court itself. We have children that seem to be very loving towards their mother. While Miss Gay did have difficulty attending all of the scheduled visitations for a person who is lower income and struggling to maintain employment, it is difficult to arrange transportation. In fact, the court even acknowledged that I understand in today's world there's a strain on people to get good jobs, there's a strain on people to find good housing, and I will say Virginia Beach is a hard place to get around. Your Honors, that's what it comes down to. And I appreciate Ms. Ilardi standing up here and saying, well, she could have worked at McDonald's. Well, if that's the way the world worked, then we would all be in a much better place. But that's not how it works. And you have lower income people who are doing the best that they can to sustain what they have. And to come in and say, you are not good enough because you can't meet our requirements is not the code and it is not the standard. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We will come, as in keeping with the tradition of this court, we will step down and greet counsel, and thereafter we will take up the case of Slentz versus the Commonwealth.
All rise.